content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's May 11, 2026 edition. As usual, the front cover of Time is bordered in red with a white narrow inner border. Before the fall is the caption at the top of the page. This is the May 11, 2026 issue. Time is in red, large block capital lettering, superimposed upon an ivory to tan graded background. There are dominoes in front. They're on end. And they're in that same tan off-white to gray coloration. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are standing on end. In the front, then, there's also a domino-shaped item that's done up in red, white, and blue. Blue and this whitish-tan vertical striping with a triangle in red on top, upon which is a five-pointed star. Beginning with the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. No one should doubt Xi Jinping's determination to bring the island of Taiwan under Beijing's direct control during his tenure as China's leader. Over the past 14 years, he has served as China's president. And he has publicly pledged many times to bring that day forward. We should not assume, however, he means to move soon. Yes, the U.S., Taiwan's indispensable ally, is now mightily distracted by war in the Middle East. The U.S. president knows many millions of American voters want fewer, not more, foreign entanglements for U.S. soldiers and sailors. But Xi has seen how both Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran have produced unpleasant surprises, much higher costs, and potential domestic political dangers for Presidents Putin and Trump, despite the clear superiority of Russian and American war-making capabilities. Taiwan has received more than enough American military hardware over the years to make war especially costly, and Taiwan's government, like those of Ukraine and Iran, has all the advantages that come with forces motivated by survival. Xi also knows his forces lack the crucial asset of battlefield experience. China has not fought a shooting war since a brief 1979 clash with Vietnam that produced mixed results, and a direct attack on Taiwan would involve crossing 100 miles of water by a Chinese navy that has never fought a naval battle. There is also reason to doubt President Xi trusts his military leadership, a point made public by his purges in recent years of a number of senior officers, well as state officials with ties to them. For all these reasons, China's leader is far more likely to order an economically strangling naval quarantine around the island in an attempt to force a Taiwanese capitulation without the risks that come with war. If that is the case, today's fears over the continued flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz will look modest next to China's ability to block transit of the world's most sophisticated semiconductors, more than 90% of which are produced on the island by the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. These chips are essential to a big percentage of the world's digital age, consumer goods, and military hardware. And yet, given the stakes for China and the world, a quarantine is not imminent either. Instead, Xi is focused for now on influencing Taiwan's January 2028 presidential election in hopes of helping defeat current President William Lai, or Lai, L-A-I, no friend of China's communists. In April, we got a glimpse of what that strategy might look like. President Xi met April 10 with Cheng Li-Wen, chairwoman of the more Beijing-friendly opposition, Kuomintang, KMT. 2 days later, China unveiled a set of new ideas to promote tighter cross-strait cooperation, including institutionalization of Beijing's communication with the KMT, a resumption of cross-strait direct flights and tourism, the import of Taiwanese agricultural and fishery products, and other practical steps. The hope is that tying these various offerings to the KMT's leader's trip to the mainland will give Taiwanese voters new reason to back the opposition. Not surprisingly, the incumbent Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, dismissed these overtures as a sugar-coated bomb and accused Beijing of working around Taiwan's popularly elected government in hopes of dividing Taiwanese society. The DPP made no move to restore an official government-to-government cross-strait dialogue, frozen since 2016. The KMT, meanwhile, has responded to this latest surge of friction by urging the DPP administration to respond constructively to goodwill from the mainland. Whether any of China's offers are accepted is beside the point. Xi intends to cast Taiwan's President Lai as a troublemaker and an obstacle to a mutually profitable reunification. For now, China's tactics are unlikely to yield a breakthrough, but the island's election is 21 months away. Xi is inclined to wait for Taiwan's voters to cast their ballots, then see what opportunities the result might create. Turning the page to the View inbox, climate is everything. By Simone Shaw, reporter. Political independents are increasingly worried about climate change. According to the latest Gallup Environment poll conducted in March, released April 14, while Republicans overwhelmingly discount warnings that the planet is warming, 46% of independents who now say the effects of global warming are underestimated is a new high. Independents also account for the record low share of U.S. adults, 35%, who say they feel positively about the environment. Unaligned voters expressing that sentiment fell 10% since 2025. Views on global warming, while always political, have grown as extreme as the weather. Just 6% of Republicans say they worry a great deal about climate change. That contrasts with 72% of Democrats and 44% of independents, whose views on climate have risen and fallen with those of Democrats. While Republicans have increasingly echoed the climate denialism reflected in President Donald Trump's policies. In 2001, slightly more than half of Republicans attributed global warming to human activities. Today, only 28% do. Given the partisan balance, the changing views of independents move the needle. The 44% of U.S. adults who worry a great deal about global warming or climate change now approaches the peak 46% measured in 2020 and 45% in 2017. A lot of different topics we cover have also seen similar shifts among independents in the last year or two, says Gallup senior editor Megan Brennan. I think it's somewhat emblematic of the popularity of the president and how well people perceive the job that he is doing. In the Loop by Nikita Ostrovsky, editorial fellow. Quantum computers capable of breaking the encryption protocols that secure the Internet may arrive sooner than expected, thanks to a new paper published by quantum computing startup Oratomic that has alarmed cybersecurity researchers. AI was instrumental to the advance, according to Oratomic. Quantum computers are built from quantum bits, or qubits, which use the counterintuitive laws of quantum mechanics to perform certain calculations much faster than possible with ordinary computers. That speed poses a threat to Internet security. Everything from WhatsApp messages to top-secret documents rely on the fact it would take the most powerful supercomputer much longer than the age of the universe to break their encryption. A quantum computer, however, could do the same work in days. Almost every system in the world becomes vulnerable altogether to a quantum attacker, says Bas Westerbaan, a cybersecurity researcher at Cloudflare. Today's quantum computers are too small to be dangerous, but a 2025 survey found a 39% chance of this changing in the next decade as quantum computers grow more powerful and the algorithms they run become more efficient. The U.S. National Institute for Standards and Technology has set a 2035 deadline to prepare for their arrival. Oratomic's result, together with a paper published concurrently by Google, could significantly shorten the development time of a quantum computer that threatens encryption, according to multiple experts who spoke to Time. The work has not yet been peer-reviewed. The world is currently, in my view, not prepared, says Dolev Blufstein, co-founder of Oratomic, which aims to build the first useful quantum computer. He said members of the team briefed U.S. officials on the findings before publication. Oratomic used an AI that combined past scientific results in a novel way, demonstrating understanding of niche subdisciplines in quantum computing as it tried thousands of different ideas. It helped the researchers find an algorithm that reduces the number of qubits required to build a dangerous quantum computer by 100 times. There's no question that we used AI to accelerate this development, says Blufstein. No question at all. The next three items will be coming from the Time Off section. Yep, that's it. Okay, the first one, Time Off Reviews. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. The movies. This is from the movies. The King of Pop gets a not-so-regal biopic. By Stephanie Zakarik. If you knew nothing about Michael Jackson, if you had no clue about his almost unfathomable gifts as an entertainer or his troubled legacy, Antoine Fuqua's workmanlike biopic, Michael, would be a fine and satisfying movie. There's lots of triumphs over adversity and a few eureka moments showing a very young performer learning to flex his formidable powers. The film ends on an up note with Jackson played by Michael's nephew, Jafar Jackson, doing an admirable job of channeling his uncle's charisma. Performing before an arena of adoring fans in London in 1988. It's not that any of these vignettes are inaccurate, it is just that they fall so far short of the complete picture, they barely capture the essence of Michael Jackson. He was an entertainer who brought intense joy to others, even as he could barely feel it himself. The earliest scenes in Michael are the most exuberant and the most affecting. It is winter time in Gary, Indiana, 1966. Tiny Michael, played by Giuliano Valdi, gazes from the window of his family's small home, watching kids playing in the snow. His father, Joseph Coleman Domingo, his features rendered indistinguishable by blobby prosthetics, barks at him to rejoin his brothers. The boys, who would become the Jackson Five, are lined up like loyal soldiers, ready to rehearse the performance their father has engineered for them. Young Michael has little confidence and goes through the motions of performance, not so much dancing as jiggling in place. Joseph berates him. The boy's mother, Catherine Nia Long, gazes sympathetically from the sidelines but does not dare speak up. Later, in response to some minor infraction, Joseph cracks his belt across little Michael's butt. It hurts, probably a lot, and Michael cries. These early scenes are unpleasant to watch. They are also the ones that feel the least burnished and most truthful. The rest of Michael, which was written by John Logan, focuses largely on the fraught father-son dynamic. As if highlighting one elephant in the room will draw our attention away from the other. The Jackson Five become stars, but Michael, by age 10, arguably one of his era's great soul singers, is clearly the anchor. The film deals with his intense loneliness. Once he and his brothers earn some money, he starts buying outlandish pets, a snake, a llama, a giraffe, a chimp named Bubbles. He tells his mother plaintively, "They're not pets, they're friends." All the while, young Michael strives to wriggle out from under his father's meaty thumb. When the Jacksons are signed to Motown Records, Michael astounds Berry Gordy, Lawrence Tate, with his version of Smokey Robinson's Who's Lovin' You. The sound, it's Michael's voice we hear on the soundtrack, resonates like an ancient missive of heartache, rather than a song emanating from a 10-year-old kid. Later, as a young man, he will try, with varying degrees of success, to grab more freedom to make his solo album, Off the Wall, and later the mega-seller Thriller. Joseph's sour, angry face is, paradoxically, the movie's guiding star. He controls the narrative, as he controlled his son's life. Did Jackson ever really free himself? The movie, made with the blessing of Jackson's estate, does not go anywhere near the allegations of sexual abuse later filed against the performer. Reportedly, an earlier finale did, but was reshot for legal reasons. That's a no-fly zone for many diehard Jackson fans, too, to even suggest that he was a troubled guy who brought trouble to others incites their wrath, but to deny Jackson's complexity only flattens his genius, as well as his kindness and fragility, into something manageable, explainable. In the end, Michael does the same. No one could survive being Michael Jackson, not even Michael Jackson. In death, as in life, he deserves much better than family and friends who will milk him for all he's worth. Turning the page now to Time Off Television. Fear and Self-Loathing in Silicon Valley, and this is by Judy Berman. Two old friends reunite around a campfire in AMC's tech industry drama, The Audacity. Men like you and me, we got a duck when SHT space FCKS, the fan. Randall Parks Gabe tells Duncan, Billy Magnuson, get an island, get some guns, and go long on guillotines. Gabe is already putting that plan into action. Once a hedonist, partying with the proceeds of the website gamblesluts.com, he is now a quasi-hermit on a luxurious private island. As Duncan notes, Gabe has armed guards where models used to gyrate. Welcome to the Silicon Valley psyche circa 2026. This siege mentality defines The Audacity. The series joins a voluminous canon of tech satires, Silicon Valley, thrillers, Westworld, sagas, Halt and Catch Fire, philosophical treatises, devs, and compilations of all the above, Black Mirror. The more this sector dominates our lives, the larger it looms in the minds of our storytellers. Yet in its portrayal of industry leaders panicking, as consensus spreads that the billionaire founders hailed as visionaries a decade ago have poisoned the world they claim to be saving, The Audacity feels the most contemporary. Its fundamental rightness about how bad the vibes are and where it all might lead makes it easier to be patient as the show sets into motion a plot that could sustain multiple seasons. At the center of a vast ensemble created by Succession alum Jonathan Glatzer are Duncan Park, the bro-ish CEO of data mining startup Hypernosis, and his therapist, Joanne Felder, Barry Breakout, Sarah Goldberg. Both are desperate, and when it serves them, ruthless. Duncan needs funding after bungling an acquisition by tech giant Cupertino. Joanne has more pedestrian financial concerns, loans, her husband Gary's, Paul Adelstein, alimony, a teenage son, Everett Blunk's Orson, with a digestive ailment. When Duncan discovers she is using clients' confessions as tips for insider trading, he blackmails her into finding him a new investor. The name she gives him is a real piece of work, a depressed zillionaire, industry demigod, Carl Bardolph, a smartly cast Zach Galifianakis, is caught between his instinct to dominate and his misgivings about what guys like himself have done to society. He's almost Shakespearean in his paralysis. Do we want to save the world or control it? Heal or conquer? For now, his conscience remains in limbo. Glatzer takes his time creating a social microcosm around Joanne and Duncan. He has a complicated relationship with Hypernosis board member Anushka Megan Rath, who heads up Cupertino's ethics department. She's married to Martin Simon Helberg, who treats his therapeutic AGI prototype as his second child. His neglected human child, Tess, Taylor Roberge, has gone full troubled teen. Gary is her therapist, and she goes to school with Orson and Duncan's daughter, Jameson, Ava Marie Telleck. Around these characters, The Audacity introduces co-workers, school staff, and Ernest, Veterans Affairs bureaucrat, Rob Cordry's Tom Ruffage. It is not until the halfway point of the 8-episode season that the plot gets moving. But if you come to TV for messy characters and insight into how they shape reality, your patience will be rewarded. Glatzer shares Succession creator Jesse Armstrong's gift for pithy dialogue, and for making a cross-section of characters stand in for larger social forces. The Felders are an upper-middle-class family struggling to pay bills. A few tax brackets higher, the divide is between those who can hire private firefighters to protect their vacation homes from wildfires, and those who can afford to bribe that squad to hose down their mansion instead. The Silicon Valley of the audacity is indeed burning, so what will the guys who lit the match rescue from the flames? Their money and power, or their souls? The Audacity airs Sundays on AMC. The View essay. This is under the heading Society, the Myth of the Adult Friend Group, by Mihika Barua, who is a journalist currently working on a memoir dealing with friendships and love. Again, this is the essay from The View. I grew up watching TV shows like Friends and Sex and the City, which glamorized a tight-knit group of adult friends who hang out together almost daily. I have spent my whole adult life trying to chase that fantasy, but it has never materialized. I have a friend I meet for dinners only, another I play tennis with, and a different one for dance classes. When I combined them together at a dinner party in the hopes that they would become friends with each other, it never worked out. Either they don't have anything in common and it's awkward, or they have so much in common that I get pushed out and they start hanging out without me. I remember being so jealous when a guy I dated celebrated his birthday three times with three different friend groups, one with childhood friends, once with university friends, once with work friends. Here I was desperately trying to curate at least one friend group that could be consistent, and he had three. How unfair. But research shows the tensions many adults feel around friendship may stem less from personal failure and more from how social connection actually works in adulthood. One recent survey found 59% of people wish they had a larger social circle, while 20% report struggling with loneliness. Other research shows people who have close confidants report higher life satisfaction and lower rates of depression. This points to a mismatch between expectation and reality. The cultural ideal of a cohesive friend group may be harder to sustain than we imagine. In practice, emotional well-being often depends on maintaining a few reliable, intimate relationships. That may help explain why many adults naturally gravitate toward one-on-one or dyad friendships. To understand this from a psychological perspective, I reached out to Suzanne Degas-White, a licensed counselor and relationship expert at the personal growth app Headway, and professor and chair of the Counseling and Higher Education Department at Northern Illinois University. She told me if we strip away the polished version of friendship portrayed in TV shows, then we would see that it is easier to maintain reciprocity between two friends than it is in larger groups. Dyad friendships allow you to learn more about one another at a much deeper level, and this increases understanding and empathy between friends, Degas-White told me. This also allows friends to have a clearer understanding of one's needs, such as being heard, seen, interested, and supported. In the absence of external noise from a group, she added, minor tensions are easier to talk through and resolve. We also have cognitive limits on maintaining stable relationships, which may explain why deep connections are sustained in smaller, more focused interactions rather than in groups. A 2023 Pew Research Center survey found A majority of adults, 53%, say they have 1 to 4 close friends. 38% say they have 5 or more friends. 8% say they have no close friends. These findings reinforce the idea that adult friendships are usually about investing deeply in a few meaningful friendships. Quality matters more than quantity. When I am in a big group of friends, I often find myself performing, trying to be the funniest or the most clever to get validation from the group, and then at times being in a group has been so overstimulating that I would barely say a word. In my one-on-one friendships, I am the most comfortable. It is only in that emotionally intimate, safe space that I have been able to be vulnerable and discuss my fears as well as my deepest thoughts. Opening up deeply in a group can change its dynamic, especially if no one else is able to do so, explained Degas White. Vulnerability can be compromised if one person turns the topic into a joke or another stays silent and is not fully engaged. I have often feared rejection in group dynamics. I remember when I was in high school, I was part of multiple different friend groups. It gave me the safety net that if one group rejected me, I could always hop on to the other one. It was also a protective mechanism to never let myself emotionally depend on one friendship so I would not be let down. Now, as an adult, I hold my friends to a certain standard and appreciate my one-on-one friends who have the emotional bandwidth to handle my complexity. There's also evidence that reciprocal one-on-one ties tend to be stronger and more influential than broader social connections because they involve mutual investment and emotional exchange. Emotional investment is what I value most in people. A good friend really wants to connect and spend quality time with me. Others only want to have a good time so they can post a group picture on social media to get the social approval of appearing to have a large group of friends. Groups also bring conflict. When people hang out in settings that are larger than one-on-one, Degas White told me, coalitions can form. We compete for closeness, and it's easy to feel left out. That is precisely why in groups of friends, it is not major betrayals that cause pain as much as it is small things. Who called whom separately? Who replied to whom faster? Who became closer, she said. We are wired for one-on-one intimacy. I realized recently I was chasing the wrong structure the entire time. Because when I look at the friendships that have actually sustained me, the ones where my friends have seen me ugly cry over a breakup or have come over to help me pack during a move, they have always been one-on-one. Letting go of the longing of a friendship group has brought me immense pride because it meant my friendships were based on reciprocity and emotional safety rather than proving myself to the outside world. I once heard the quote, "You can tell how much you love yourself by the partner that you have chosen." And I think about that in terms of friendships too. We are often taught to measure our social lives by how many people we can gather in a room, but quality matters over quantity. Just like in romantic relationships, friendship is just two people choosing each other over and over again. In this edition, Time is listing the 100 most influential companies of 2026 and how they are shaping the world. Again, this is Time's list. The first one mentioned comes with a rather long article, which I will totally abridge. Alphabet, the clairvoyant, Andrew R. Chow writes this from Mountain View, California. Many years ago, Sundar P. Pichai was scuba diving with his family in Hawaii when the weather turned unexpectedly rough. As Pichai, P-I-C-H-A-I, entered the water, waves pummeled his lanky frame. He wondered if he should return to safety. Eventually, he kicked downward. Just a few feet below Pichai found the calmest place in the world, he says, and became possessed by a meditative stillness. I feel that in any situation there's a layer which is super calm, in which, if you can get there, you can observe what's going on, he says, and your mind's energy is focused on what you need to do. This anecdote, which Pichai relays in Google's Mountain View headquarters on a Wednesday afternoon in April, is almost too on the nose. As CEO of Google and Alphabet, Pichai runs the second most valuable company in the world and could earn $692 million himself over the next 3 years, pending Google's stock performance. But he's practically anonymous compared with other tech CEOs who love making waves: Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Sam Altman. Some 8,700 miles separate Pichai's current home in Silicon Valley from his birthplace. He was raised in Chennai, a southern Indian metropolis, in a modest house. He and his brother slept on the living room floor. Growing up, his family progressively gained a series of transformative technologies: a water heater, a refrigerator, a rotary telephone. When the phone arrived, so too did his neighbors, flocking to his house to call their families or the hospital for medical records. But the rollouts were agonizingly slow. It took 5 years to get off a government wait list to secure a telephone. For Pichai, it was an early example of why technology should sometimes ship faster than the speed of bureaucracy. I do feel a sense of urgency around it all, he says. Pichai arrived in the U.S. in 1993, where he earned master's degrees in science and business from Stanford and Wharton, before joining Google in 2004 in product management. The same month, Gmail launched. He quickly rose through the ranks because of his ambition, work ethic, and instinct for what users wanted, his collaborators say. In Silicon Valley, there are a handful of archetypal leaders like Steve Jobs as the visionary, or Zuckerberg as the engineer. Pichai is the ultimate product leader, those collaborators say. He was the driving force behind Chrome and Drive, even when senior leaders doubted those projects' viability. He has this ability to fully simulate a product in his head and how it will be received and used by end customers, says Clay Bavor, a former Google executive who worked directly under Pichai for a decade. He has an exceptional sense for craft and the details in a product, all the way down to the pixels on the screen, the sound of a voice, the tactile feedback. When Pichai took over as CEO in 2015 from co-founder Larry Page, he had a vision in mind. Most people still treated thinking machines as sci-fi fantasy, so it caught other leaders in the company off guard when, in 2016, Pichai announced Google would be shifting its priority from mobile-first to AI-first experiences. This paves the future for Google for the next 10 years or so, he declared in an internal meeting that year. Not everyone was convinced. Before late 2022, AI chatbots were mostly a punchline. One 2016 effort from Microsoft Tay had been pulled from the web after producing racist and sexist messages. Google had been building chatbots internally, but the reputational risk of releasing them was too high, especially because the company was facing antitrust concerns. The main signal I took away was that, wow, the Overton window has shifted, says Pichai, referring to the concept of how something previously considered radical can become mainstream. The technology is still imperfect, but people are more ready for it than we fully internalized. This year, Google has faced internal blowback not seen at the company since the first Trump administration, when Pichai himself participated in an employee protest against the president's immigration policies. In February, more than 1,000 Google workers signed an open letter demanding the company end its partnerships with DHS and ICE. An additional 100 DeepMind employees signed a letter asking Jeff Dean, Google's chief scientist for red lines around the usage of Gemini by the Pentagon, for surveilling American citizens or piloting autonomous weapons without a human in the loop. Google has 190,000 employees. DeepMind has around 6,000. Skeptics of Pichai's ambitions might consider his record. Over the past decade, he foresaw the rise of video content creators, self-driving cars, mainstream AI tools, despite being told they were a distraction. Now Google controls every level of the AI stack: research, chips, cloud, software, hardware. Among the existing public companies, they are the best positioned because they have more pieces than anybody. The company also has a massive amount of cash, announcing in February it could double its spending on capital expenditures this year to over $175 billion. I have a lot of trust in people and their ability to use and adapt to technology, Pichai says. We will need frameworks unlike we've ever had before, but I expect humanity to rise to the moment. Okay, here are a few more of Time's chosen 100 tech companies. SpaceX, the rocket factory. Aerospace phenom SpaceX logged a record-breaking 165 launches of its Falcon 9 rocket last year, and that is not all that makes SpaceX a pace setter. Its Starlink constellation of nearly 9,500 satellites has brought internet to conflict zones in Ukraine, Gaza, and Iran. The company's Starship rocket, the most powerful launch vehicle ever built, is set for its 12th test flight this spring. COO Gwynne Shotwell says SpaceX's 10-year plan is to take up to 100 passengers at a time to the moon. Jeffrey Kluger wrote that. And Avery Stone writes this about Netflix streaming behemoth. In February, in a shocking reversal, Netflix walked away from the $82.7 billion bid to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery after refusing to counter Paramount Skydance's revised offer of $111 billion. The move was hardly an indication of weakness. In 2025, the streaming giant delivered $45.2 billion in revenue, up 16% from 2024, and surpassed 325 million global paid subscribers. In 2026, it's doubling down on investing in live sports and events. Partnerships with prominent podcasters and content creators, games, and AI-powered discovery, search, advertising, and creation tools. including acquiring Ben Affleck's AI filmmaking company, Interpositive, in March. Co-CEO Greg Peters says Netflix's ability to play in both the creative and tech spaces gives the company its edge. They can be as good as us in one, he says of competitors, but being as good in both is tough. Ant Group, that's A-N-T Group, China's fintech giant. This is written by Charlie Campbell. Chinese finance conglomerate Ant Group has spent the past year building Alipay Plus, that's A-L-I-P-A-Y Plus, into a vast cross-border digital wallet network spanning more than 100 markets. But the bigger shift has been Ant's strategic repositioning as an AI-first company, with R&D spending hitting a record of $3.26 billion in 2024. Last year, it also debuted an AI healthcare app that lets users ask medical questions of over 5,000 hospitals and nearly 1 million doctors. It had more than 100 million users in its first 10 months. Toyota, ahead on hybrids by Amy Rollins. The Prius was the first mass-produced hybrid on the market when Toyota, the world's top-selling car maker, debuted it in 1997. The company has doubled down on hybrids, now popular as EV growth slows and charging infrastructure lags. Through August 2025, nearly half of all new hybrid registrations in the U.S. were for vehicles made by Toyota. In March, the carmaker announced a nearly $1 billion investment in U.S. manufacturing to build more vehicles and EV parts stateside. Dell Technologies, building AI infrastructure by Taryn Pillay. Companies once turned to Dell for off-the-shelf servers, PCs, other hardware. Now it is one of the leading suppliers of AI factories. Unlike data centers that store and process data, they are integrated systems combining computing with networking, storage, software to run AI at scale. Dell partnered with NVIDIA to deploy these systems to over 4,000 customers, including Lowe's, McLaren, and CoreWeave. AI server sales reached $26 billion in early 2026, more than doubling since a year prior. Saudi Aramco, global power player, by Vivian Walt. The world's biggest oil company is also one of the most profitable, raking in $104.7 billion last year. It acts as the last resort supplier in crises like the Iran war. Even as Iranian drones blasted Saudi Arabia, Aramco, that's A-R-A-M-C-O, piped 7 million barrels a day to the kingdom's Red Sea port, giving Saudi Arabia global clout in politics and business beyond oil. Aramco's profits underpin much of the country's growth in industries like tourism. In recent years, it has funneled billions into the sovereign wealth fund. Boeing, New Heights by Joe Mullock. In 2025, Boeing outpaced rival Airbus in orders. America's top exporter by value, Boeing delivered some 600 jets and secured commitments from Air India, Air Cambodia, and Delta. After deadly crashes, factory strikes, and a mid-air panel blowout, Boeing overhauled operations, launching a war on defects. In October, the Federal Aviation Administration raised production caps imposed after the blowout. The company returned to profitability after 7 years in 2025. APR, K-butyphenom, by Nina Derwin. APR is leading the next wave of K-buty growth worldwide. In August, the Seoul-based firm grew into South Korea's largest beauty company by market cap. In 2025, APR reported over $1 billion in annual revenue, with 80% of that coming from overseas. Driving APR's swift rise internationally is its top-selling Medicube brand, known for innovative skincare products and devices that dominate on social media platforms like TikTok, and an expanded U.S. presence. Veolia, V-E-O-L-I-A, Cleaning Up PFAS, by Don Steinberg. One of the world's largest water services companies is removing the forever from forever chemicals, toxic per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, linked to cancers and other illnesses, linger in the environment and can accumulate in the body. In 2025, French firm Veolia opened a massive plant in Delaware that filters PFAS from water and incinerates it to break the bond between fluorine and carbon, one of the strongest in chemistry. The plant filters 30 million gallons per day, delivering cleaner drinking water to more than 100,000 residents. The company treated more than 7.6 billion cubic meters of water last year and is on track to have more than 100 PFAS water treatment sites across the U.S. in the coming years. Growing public concern about PFAS creates opportunity. Veolia is targeting 1 billion euros or $1.16 billion in revenue from mitigating micropollutants by 2030. And the last one on this page, BYD, best-selling EVs, by Charlie Campbell. BYD founder Wang Xuanfu set his sights on creating an EV brand that would be known all over the planet for high-spec engineering at the lowest possible price. Today, his dream is a reality. BYD vehicles are sold in over 70 countries with factories in Brazil, India, Japan, California, and later this year, Hungary. With 4.6 million vehicle deliveries last year, BYD surpassed Tesla to become the world's top EV maker on total annual sales. BYD claims its revolutionary new battery can charge in just 5 minutes. Here's a photo that I'll describe. This is from a photo spread about Cuba. On one side, it's a very leafy, verdant scene, a big tree with sea grape leaf tree in Varadero, Cuba. And it's a boy. He's wearing blue jeans and white sneakers and a gray sweater and a white collared shirt. He has a very short cut, well, pretty short cut, curly brown-black hair. He has brown skin, and he's playing a guitar, strumming a guitar in the shade. And on the verso is a photo, not quite as verdant looking. It's in a rather dark room with tan walls. walls and what appear to be gray marble or slate tiles surrounding a sink. There is a window. It looks like it's tall and it has double panes. The caption reads, "A caregiver assists an elderly resident in the Santo Venia convent in Havana." There are actually two elderly women shown in this photo. It looks like one is eating porridge or oatmeal from a cereal bowl, and she has a partly filled glass of juice, also perhaps orange juice. It's light orange in color. And then a woman who's wearing a surgical mask, a younger woman with dark hair and dark skin, is feeding. She's spooning something out of a cereal bowl to another elderly woman. And the elderly woman looks frail. She does look frail. By the way, they're at a table, and the one lady who's eating from the cereal bowl is seated, while the other lady, the frail-looking, tiny woman, is standing. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generally supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number here at the office and studios is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.